You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped, first broadcast on the 21st of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. Hello and welcome to the 8th edition of Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. Produced from our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore, and at Midori House right here in London, this is your unmissable weekly briefing from the world's most dynamic region. I'm your host, Ben Ryland. Coming up on the program, we're travelling to the mountainous Indonesian city of Bandung to hear about how a tapestry of influences is affecting the city's architecture.
There's a market for creative things, for nicely worked out, nicely crafted products as well, because, you know, shopping is one of the leisure activities, and with that also Bandung is thriving.
Then we'll cross to our Tokyo bureau, where Kenji Hall has been enjoying the pleasures of glamping, or as some might call it, camping, just without the bugs and cold hard ground.
They're targeting couples, the elderly. It's a romantic getaway. It's just a pure getaway from the city. It has broad appeal.
And later in the show, we'll continue today's architectural theme when I sit down with Brisbane architects Adrian Spence and Ingrid Richards. All that right here on Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, and this is Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ, the show where we take a closer look at the world's most dynamic region and explore emerging opportunities. Well, starting things off today, we're headed to the land of the long white cloud. The New Zealand government has committed $125 million to become a founding member of the Asian Infrastructure Bank. Some fairly significant loose change there. So what's behind all the spending? Well, journalist Kate Goodsell joins me on the line now from Auckland. Kate, welcome to the show. Can you give us a bit of background on this one?
Basically, when you look at New Zealand, we're a small nation on the other side of the world who has to export a lot. So we're really looking to Asia for our growth, basically. So it's seen as a very smart move on the government's part, a very strategic move to kind of forge these ties in Asia to develop that infrastructure, which could potentially help our exports get out to that part of the world.
And so, Kate, how is this being digested by voters over there in New Zealand? People have been fairly sceptical over the nation's economy in the recent past, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. I think a lot of people have been quite concerned about maybe we haven't, New Zealand has an overexposure to dairy and an over-reliance on the Chinese market. But this isn't just the Chinese market, from what I understand, this is Asia as a whole. And I think actually it's been very well received by businesses. I think they'll be really interested in the fact that there's an opportunity now to kind of get into a much, much bigger market, because really our trade, main trade, has always been with Australia. But over the last few years, it's really, really grown much strongly with China. So this is a, you know, good opportunity for them to develop those into those markets even further. And I think the other thing that's actually worth noting is that, in terms of, you're talking about voters, one of the big things is that New Zealand does have has warming ties definitely with the US over the last few years under the Key administration. And the US has been very vocal about this infrastructure bank and sort of being in opposition of it. So I think a lot of people will see New Zealand's stance of investing in this bank as a way of showing its independence as well. So I think that's, you know, voters will quite like that as well. Even people like the Green Party, who may have an issue with something like this, particularly because of China's reputation with human rights and those sort of issues, even they have sort of welcomed the move. They've been quite positive about it. So, yeah, it's generally seen as actually a really big tick for the government to go and establish this.
And now, Kate, moving on to the list of top 50 companies in New Zealand. It comes with the usual mix of predictions and surprises, but there's a rather conspicuous absence in there too, isn't there?
Well, this, you know, obviously we have a top 50 index, which is part of our stock exchange. And essentially, one of the papers, the big papers over here, the New Zealand Herald, did quite an interesting sort of survey of what the chief executives of the top 50 get paid, how their salaries have grown exponentially against, you know, what their sort of average workers has. But what really came out of it was actually only one of those top 50 chief executives was a woman, but she's actually not in that role anymore. So really what's come out of this has been, there's been a lot of reaction in terms of, you know, women in that kind of, not just the governance role, but really at the top of the helm, driving business and developing women in that role.
And finally, let's chat quickly about a software company over there that's begun expanding its horizons far beyond the lovely green plains of New Zealand.
Wynyard Group is a really interesting company that was started in Christchurch a couple of years ago, which is where they had the big earthquakes in New Zealand about a few years ago. And it's a security software company which is used by stock exchanges and law enforcement agencies, and they use them to solve crimes and also predict crimes, I understand. And it's things like drug smuggling, human trafficking, gun running, financial crimes, all that sort of thing. And they've got offices all over the place in the UK, in the US, Canada, Australia. And so they've just signed up a deal with Motorola, which they're hoping will drive sales in the law enforcement area in the US. So that's a really good entry point for them into the US. And the partnership with Motorola will basically get them access to about 100,000 global customers in this law enforcement and national security sectors. And on top of that, they've just done another capital raising of $45 million to kind of just keep on expanding globally. But they're a real one to watch, I'd say.
One to watch indeed, Kate. Thanks for joining us. Journalist Kate Goodsell there on the line from Auckland. You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
In the lead-up to Monocle's Quality of Life survey, which is in the latest issue of our magazine, on newsstands now, Singapore Bureau Chief Nolan Giles travelled to the mountainous Indonesian city of Bandung. Now, while he was there, he met up with the popular architect-turned-mayor Ridwan Kamil, who is leading the country's third-largest city through an immense creative growth. Nolan also got the chance to chat with the young architecture and design firms setting up shop in the city. One such firm, working closely with Kamil on major public projects, is Shao, an international architecture practice led by Florian Heinzelman and Deliana Suryawinata. The business has just transferred its Jakarta office to Bandung, and he asked the couple to take us through their experience in expanding Shao into this Indonesian creative hub.
Once we decided to come to Bandung, we were a bit in a hurry, but Dana found this co-working space. And this is sort of like the seed how we got to know Bandung also better, because there's a lot of collaboration going on, a lot of different people with a different background. And then once we moved here, you know, we saw the full impact of this creativity here. So there are like a lot of graphic designers, fashion. I mean, of course, it starts with copying brands, but, you know, there's also, you know, a lot of people doing their own brands, and everybody's like an entrepreneur and it's just starting off. So, you know, there's a lot of IT related to the ITB, the Institute Technology Bandung, programming, apps, web design, things like this. So it is like a big mixture of everybody is just doing things and trying things out. And of course we can tap into that, and this is very, very amazing.
We feel that we can expand our practice here in a more multidisciplinary manner, where we can immediately collaborate with IT people, with graphic designers, product designers, and so on. And that doesn't happen everywhere. And That's because we're at the Cohen co-working space. Mm. It's a very good place to explore Bandung, as well as we learn so much from our friends here in the community.
And you're not just doing small projects either. You're doing major projects and you've got sort of a decent number of staff. Is Bandung a city that has an aspiration to do big things for design in Indonesia?
Well, I think Bandung is right now known as a design city, and it does attract young people to come here and to try out things. They know when they have to compare an office in Bandung and Jakarta, for example, they would imagine that Bandung offices are more experimental, braver, and it has become a lab for trying out new design things, new strategies, new products. So I think Bandung itself is a magnet attractor for young creative people to come over and to collaborate and make a lot of babies and products.
I mean, Bandung is also living from tourism, right? So it's very close, 150 kilometers from Jakarta. So every weekend, Jakartans come over. And of course, they're not the poorest Jakartans. So there comes money in. And in that sense, there's a market for creative things, for nicely worked out, nicely crafted products as well. Because, you know, this shopping is one of the leisure activities. And, you know, with that, also Bandung is thriving and stimulating the creative industry.
And additionally, with Ridwan Kamil's presence, Bandung gets an additional magnet for people to come, because he's very open to different proposals, different possibilities. He changed the total graphic design style of the city. He changed the signages. He improves public parks. So there are many works here for creative people to contribute to the city and that they can be realized.
Yeah, exactly. I think the realization is exactly the point. Because look, if you're an architecture student, you can think about a lot of things, but at least in Europe, it's very difficult to step out and then just really implement the things. And then with a mayor like Ridwan Kamil, there's a much higher degree of implementation, and also on a smaller scale as well as a big scale. So it gives the opportunities for a lot of different people with a different background, being it age, experience, you know, as well as being established. So it has something to offer for everybody, like a bigger architecture firm, as well as like small startups which just came straight out of university.
And there's a lot of talk at the moment about the growing economy in Indonesia and a growing middle class. And as business owners, are you feeling that growth already?
Wow, that's a difficult question.
we see that as the GDP grows, people get more consumeristic. And it's a very interesting crossing right now where Indonesians are. As they get more wealthy, as we get more wealthy, how do we consume? How do we put our lifestyle at its healthiest or at its best in the city? So there are many things, and we can discuss over consumption and lifestyle for a few hours, but we do feel that people get more cars. People are spending more money on different kind of food. There are new growing businesses coming up, and we feel it, but we also question, where is this lifestyle going to be? Is it going to end up in more luxurious shopping malls, or are we going to innovate and consume in a healthier lifestyle that we could never do before?
Monocle's Singapore Bureau Chief Nolan Giles there in conversation with Florian Heinzelman and Deliana Suryawinata in Indonesia. And we'll have more from the burgeoning world of architecture later in the show when I sit down with Brisbane's Adrian Spence and Ingrid Richards. This is AsiaPac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
I'm Ben Rylan, and you're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. Now, if you're anything like me, the concept of camping comes with childhood memories of mosquitoes, struggling to get in and out of your jeans each day, and attempting to wash dishes in a running creek. Or maybe that was just how Australians did it way back in the 90s. For the Japanese, however, camping has undergone a bit of a facelift, and thankfully so. Gone are the days of stinky bug repellent and inflatable mattresses. Ladies and gentlemen, glamping has arrived. What's glamping? Well, let's put that question to Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, who joins me now from our Tokyo bureau. Kenji, you've just been out exploring this glamping idea. Tell us about it.
I've just been to an event run by a company called Cafe Company. What they do is they have an undeveloped plot of land in central Tokyo in an area called Omotesando. It's the fashion district. And they've turned it into this festive area for food carts and casual outdoor dining. They hosted a three-day event, a glamping event. And glamping, as you might know, is a combination of the words glamour and camping. The idea is you get to enjoy the great outdoors minus the inconveniences, things like bugs and bad food and whatnot. So during this three-day event, what Cafe Company did is they organized a free-flowing champagne event. They also had a Michelin-starred chef from Osaka come and cook meals for small groups of people for lunch and dinner over the course of the 3 days. And so this was a chance to appeal to an audience that might normally think about going to a campsite. And yet, you know, this was a way to show them that camping can be a little bit more than just dirt and campfires and bad weather.
And Kenji, we've actually got a bit of audio from that event. It was held at Commune 246 in Tokyo's Omotesando district. This is the Cafe Company's Koichi Ishiwata.
This is for someone who doesn't camp or isn't used to camping. Someone who has a preference for beautiful things. It's nothing like a high-end hotel, and yet you get some of the amenities of one, such as meals. This is for those people. If it's too outdoorsy, you might scare people away. But if there are too urban elements, some people might see that's too comfortable and think, I can do this. This is another side of luxury.
So, Kenji, is this something being pushed by the industry to sort of forge a new market? Or is it really just down to people getting a little bit tired of taking shelter under a piece of cloth for enjoyment?
Well, I think it's a little of both. You know, camping is a very popular pastime here in Japan now. It's become more diverse, and this is actually a good thing because it offers more for a very different sector of people. People have the time and the money to spend, and obviously, you know, getting people interested in the great outdoors is a good thing. It also helps to, you know, encourage local governments to preserve their natural resources. It's taken a little while to spread here in Japan, I think probably because camping has always been a fairly organized thing in Japan. You have great facilities and well-organized campsites. It's not as rustic as, you know, you might think. For instance, lifestyle brand Muji, they run several campsites around Japan. At these campsites, which are mostly clearings facing a lake or a large river, they host seminars, they do outdoor activities, you know, things like fishing and canoeing, and it's for both adults and children. And so, you know, you're not just going out into the woods and tromping around, you're actually being presented with the possibility of having fun with other people who are also at this campsite.
Well, I have to admit, the idea of Muji running a campsite would probably be just enough to convince me to give it a go. But they're not the only big brand switching onto all of this, are they? Hoshino Resorts are taking a dip into the industry too.
That's right. This year in late October, just in time for the fall foliage season, Hoshino Resorts is planning to open a new resort called Hoshinoya Fuji. Hoshino Resorts is known for its boutique hotels. They run boutique hotels in Kyoto, Karuizawa, and Taketomi. This is an island in Okinawa. But this is the only one of the higher-end resorts that taps into this glamping trend. It's in a forest. It's next to Kawaguchiko, which is a freshwater lake at the foot of Mount Fuji. You rent one of 40 small cabins. Each cabin has a terrace and a wood-burning stove. You know, you sleep on beds with fresh linen, and you eat multi-course meals of grilled meats and farm produce. You sit around campfires while staff in waistcoats serve you. obviously the cost is not the usual cost of camping. It's 45,000 yen per person per night, which is about 320 euros. So it's not cheap. But they're targeting couples, the elderly. It's a romantic getaway. It's just a pure getaway from the city. It has broad appeal.
So what's the feeling over there in the Tokyo Bureau? Are you tempted to venture into the world of glamping for your next holiday, Kenji? Or will you be sticking to the ye old luxury hotel?
Interesting that you ask. Actually, the company that Cafe Company worked with for this glamping event last weekend, called First Class Backpackers Inn, they run a glamping site on Awaji Island in western Japan. I'm actually planning to go later this year, sometime this summer, with my family to test the waters. You know, they have tents set up, and instead of sleeping bags, you sleep on these low futon-like mattresses. So it's a little, and the interior is slightly, it's not so Japanese. They try to bring in elements of Africa and the Middle East to make it slightly more exotic. So there's a little bit of, it feels a little contrived, I think, but at the same time, you know, it's kind of, the barrier is set low for folks who don't normally go out and camp. So it will be, a good experience for my family.
I shall be awaiting the postcard then. Kenji Hall, Monocle's Asia editor at large, joining us there from our Tokyo bureau. The sunny city of Brisbane in Australia is no stranger to modern architectural prestige. It's been undergoing a bit of a design renaissance in recent years, providing a much-needed breakaway from its past saturation of ugly concrete. For Ingrid Richards and Adrian Spence, it's the perfect time to be at the epicentre of the city's revival. As the partnership at the helm of Richards and Spence Architecture, they're a driving force behind some of Brisbane's most impressive new structures. They popped into Midori House here in London a little earlier for a chat about how they approach the concept of renewal in their city, and we started by discussing the issue of grand, old and ageing post offices in Australia and beyond.
The post office is an interesting one because it's happened in all our capital cities where they've been sold, and it's a really sad thing, I think, to this building that the public felt like they had ownership of is being sold to a sort of private enterprise.
And that function, which is a really kind of amazing thing that we can send post, I think. Like, it's something that we take for granted and we don't utilise it very often because we have the internet and we don't use mail in the same way. But there's nothing more exciting than getting a package in the post. And at the moment, you know, people are just getting their bills. So there's a kind of a negative connotation with it. But now that that function is in shopping centres and in very kind of basic buildings with the right amount of car parking, and it's lost its civic presence that it once had.
It's really lost its prestige, and I suppose whereas they once were something that was grand and palatial, now they've become very functional and in places where they are convenient, like shopping centres.
But what's interesting is that if you look on, again, the UBD, the street directory of a city, the centre of the city was determined by the general post office, and the dimensions were radiated out from that. So now potentially, and I don't know if in the case of the H&M store that's the case, but, you know, that's how the city was seen. It was seen as a central aspect of the orientation and the significance of a place, and now there's a single clothes boutique. And, I mean, we need these places, we need shops, but there's something to be said about maintaining civic uses and places that strangers and the general public will use. So it's a part of a general disappointment with selling public spaces for specific use, understanding that there's often a hybrid solution. And I think that's the mistake, is just to say, well, it's not working, we're going to do something completely different. There's probably more finessed resolutions to things like post offices.
Well, of course, that is something that you take into account with some of your projects, which a lot of them are multi-use. Can you explain maybe some of the methods that you would use to approach to something that needs to be used for a variety of different reasons?
I think in the way Ingrid was describing, to have that sort of convenience-based retail layer to the recreational-based retail layer makes it automatically part of people's kind of everyday. And so they kind of help each other in that way. Whereas I think if they're purely fashion retail or purely food retail or, you know, purely furniture retail or whatever it is, if it's too departmentalized, then it kind of doesn't work. So I think to integrate into and be truly civic needs to be part of people's everyday life, so that all those accidental social interactions happen just as part of their day. And then all of a sudden that shopping centre becomes a public space.
But there's things that, so when we're looking at the arcades in London, for instance, there's incredible skill and infrastructure in place for retail to make those public uses. And whether it's a seat on the street or the basic feeling that those arcades are publicly accessible. So they're external in nature, even though they might be sheltered. And so therefore there's this impression from people that everyone is able to go there. A shopping centre doesn't give that facility. So I guess we're always looking at trying to find a method to make sure everyone feels that they can use it, because then it means that people will be there in a less forced fashion, as you know, that when they arrive, they don't feel like they have to buy something, and therefore they'll stay and look, and then eventually they're more likely to. And that's part of the design of an entry to a store or a place to sit or a public style of room that's covered from the elements. And we talk about this a lot, the idea that trying to find something that's public and charming, which is really hard to define. And we use the idea of a first date being, if you could go there and imagine that you've chosen this as a first date location and it's succeeded as a public space and it's succeeded in being charming. And that idea of charm is not ever talked about, I don't think, in a retail. Retail always gets reverted into dimensions and plan area. It's never volumetric, it's never spatial or qualitative when it's directed. So the specialists don't tend to have that attitude towards it, but so we try and be a bit more hybrid and treat it like a public building than a place that's purely for shopping.
Architects Ingrid Richards and Adrian Spence there. Now, they're usually based out of the lovely inner Brisbane suburb of Fortitude Valley, and they popped in for a visit here at Midori House while they were in London recently. And that just about brings us to the end of this edition of Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. The show was produced by our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore, and of course by me, Ben Ryland, right here at Midori House in London. The lovely Nina Norick was our editor. Asia Pac Unwrapped is back at the same time next week. That's 7 a.m. Monday in Sydney, 9 a.m. in Wellington, and 2200 hours on Sunday here in London. Of course, you can listen again and find out more over at monocle.com or tune in via iTunes or SoundCloud or the handy little Monocle app. This is Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Until next time, I'm Ben Ryland. Enjoy your week.